One of the challenges of keeping a days of unleavened bread, or prior to it, preparing for it, is knowing what is and what isn't leaven. Usually every year I get calls from somebody, they ask a question, there's this ingredient in this particular product, is that leavening or not? And I usually have to have Karen answer that, because I don't know that much about it. It's pretty simple in Old Testament Israel. I mean, they just had sourdough and that was it, you know? It didn't take very long to get rid of it. Today, we've got so many different ingredients that you don't know what in the world they are, let alone whether they're leavened or not. So, obviously, we have to check ingredients and perhaps even Google the ingredient. You might think about that. Put the ingredient up there and put leavening or something and see what you find out that way. Of course, more importantly, we need to know what is and isn't sin, so we know what to put out in order to be spiritually unleavened. So let's take a look at some of the things that... Oh, come on, now what? I pushed start on this dumb thing, and it's beeping at me. Everything beeps at you nowadays, you know? All right, let's try that again. I don't know. It probably knows I'm not a techie, so... Well, that's... Maybe it's low and bad, I don't know. Dumb thing away. I got too many things beeping at me already. At least they don't have the heart monitor anymore, and our cars don't have snapshots anymore. We're going to celebrate about that. Oh, boy. I thought about doing a blog titled, "Does That Bleepin' Beepin'?" You know, it's just... All right, so anybody listens to this and wonder, what in the world is this guy talking about? So getting back to the story here, we're going to take a look at some scriptures, actually primarily in Ephesians, Colossians, which are pretty much parallel letters in a way, with ample quotes from the New Daily Study Bible by Barclay, to help us understand what these ingredients mean. Because you can look at a product and it tells you some great big long name and you think, okay, so what is that? And frankly, there are sometimes in the Bible, you read these big words and you think, okay, so what is that? Well, fortunately, we have reference sources, and Barclay is one of the good ones that can shed a lot of light on it and tell us not only what it means, but how it applies in our life. So let's turn, first of all, to Ephesians chapter 4. We'll be spending some time there, first of all, before we go to Colossians 3, which is a very similar area of Scripture. Ephesians chapter 4, and we're going to start in verse 17 and read verses 17 and 18 to begin with. Ephesians 4, verse 17, "This I say," Paul writes, "therefore, and testify in the Lord, that you should no longer walk as the rest of the Gentiles walk in the futility of their mind." And of course, when the Bible talks about walking, it doesn't mean how you take your steps. It's talking about how you live your life. So going on in Ephesians 4, 17, it says, "Don't walk as the rest of the Gentiles walk in the futility of their mind, having their understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that's in them, because of the blindness of their heart." And of course, we can substitute there for Gentiles. Put in the word unbelievers. I mean, you look at the world outside today, and you see a lot of futility, right? You see people just kind of not knowing what it's all about and stumbling and bumbling their way through life. The word, the Greek word futility, in one of the resources says it means without use or value, emptiness, purposelessness, transitoriness. All those are kind of synonyms of what this word translated futility actually means. And I think it's good at this time of year for us to look back in our personal lives before God began dealing with us and realize that probably none of us were living in futility. You know, just wondering what life's all about and wandering around, stumbling and bumbling and that type of thing. Of course, if you're brought up in, you know, our church culture, that would be less true. But even there, I think sometimes a lot of young people kind of have to bumble around before they realize that they were in a pretty good situation, and they probably ought to go back to that and get squared away again. So, skipping down to verse 22 then in Ephesians chapter 4, it says to put off concerning your former conduct the old man which grows corrupt according to the deceitful lusts. I'm going to read that In a couple other translations that make it, I think, a little more clear. The New Living says, throw off your old sinful nature and your former way of life, which is corrupted by lust and deception. And, you know, times haven't changed since then, right? There's probably more deception around now than there was then. At least it's proliferated a lot more because of the internet. So that certainly is still very applicable. The New Revised Standard Version puts it this way. You were taught to put away your former way of life, your old self, corrupt and deluded by its lusts. And the expression, the old man, that's found in King James and New King James, is basically referring to our whole way of life prior to God's calling, the old person that needs to be put away. And actually even says put to death in some scriptures, pretty strong words. The verb, what it talks about being put off, it's called the aorist tense in Greek, A-O-R-I-S-T, for curiosity. It denotes a once and for all definite concluding action. It's just like decisive action. Put it away. That should be our determination. Even though, of course, it's a lifelong process. I mean, we can put it away, but it keeps popping up again. You have to keep putting it away. I'm reminded of this game that I played. I don't remember where it was or when it was. Maybe you've seen it at carnivals where these heads pop up and you have this hammer. You have to keep pounding down these heads and they keep popping up all over the place. What is it?
Whack-a-mole.
Okay. So you know what I'm talking about. You don't have to Google it. That's good. Yeah, so, I mean, it kind of reminds me of that. Every time you think you've got something you're putting away, something else pops up. You know, I've got to pop it in the head and knock it down again, that type of thing. Even though initially it's a very, very decisive action. And also there's another grammatical thing here. It's called the middle voice, which you don't need to know what it is. But basically, when the middle voice is used, we have active tense and passive tense. And this is kind of in the middle, sort of a little both. And what it indicates is something that is done by the subject that benefits that person. So we don't have anything like that in English. Just kind of a little more emphasis. So putting away the old man is something we do, and it's something that has a benefit to us when we do it. Now here's something, and I think you're going to hear this again from Mr. Richards in his sermon on the Holy Day, is when you're talking about putting out leaven, you're talking about putting out bad habits, bad qualities. It's a law of nature. You can't just take something like that away without putting something back in return. It just doesn't work very well. And I'm going to talk more about that also in the sermon I give on the... I'm going to be speaking here now on the first Holy Day. No, I'm sorry, the last Holy Day. We switched because I'll be doing the Passover in Medford. That way we can stay over and do the first day instead of having to rush back here and then go back down again the last day. So anyway, you all remember Mr. Armstrong's analogy, right? Or a lot of you do. To get taking air out of a bottle, how's the best way to do it? Put in some water. It gets the air out. You can't get a straw and get all the air out. It doesn't happen. So there's a very important principle involved here. Like I said, I'll talk more about it in the next sermon. But we'll notice here when we go through these passages in Ephesians 4 and Colossians 3 that it talks about things to put off and things to put on. Just a little different preposition. We talk about putting leaven out and putting something else in. This is talking about putting off bad qualities and putting in good qualities. But it's still same thing, regardless of the different prepositions. But the thing they have in common is the prepositions are opposite. In and out are opposite. On and off are opposites. So it's a situation here where we're dealing with both things we need to get rid of and also things we need to put back in their place. So, and this is true, this is known by other people too. It's not just something we know in our church culture. One of the things that, and some of you may have dealt with this if you ever had a smoking problem and quit, you need to, especially right at first, put something in its place. Even things like, you know, a person can be used to reaching in their pocket for a pack of cigarettes. So I've known people just put something else in there. So when you reach in there, you pull this thing out, maybe it's a card that says don't smoke or something like that. I know alcoholics, in my experience as a chaplain at Serenity Lane, I noticed this quite a bit, that what would happen a lot of times is a person that's quitting drinking will just smoke a lot more. That's not a good idea. That's taking something bad out and putting something bad, just as bad, back in. So the real definition of sobriety is to not have any chemical dependency. And a lot of times candy is something that's substituted as well. You know, my dad really had a lot of candy. He called a candy bar a bar of candy, was his word for it. And that's not as bad, but it's still that principle that we're involved there. There's a book out there, I think I have a copy of it somewhere, at least I used to have, titled Positive Addiction. And there are actually clinics that use this particular treatment modality, if you want to call it that. They actually help people who have an addiction by taking them out on the track and having them run, because it increases, what is it, dopamines and endorphins and that kind of thing, which really help a person's state of mind. So there's a good example there, too, of what this author calls positive addiction. Any of you who have been, say, joggers, I used to back in the day, I finally retired from it because I'd like to keep my original hips and knees if I can. And it's not really good to be pounding on the pavement with that type of thing. But anyway, you kind of get addicted to that. And so a person who's really in shape, if they quit, say, for even a week, you can become totally detrained. And a lot of people don't really know what it means to feel good. If you experience what's called the training effect from running and you lose that temporarily, you just don't feel as good. You feel restless and all this kind of stuff. So that's another example of how you need to put something back and when you take something out. All right, let's go on to verse 23 and 4 of Ephesians 4. It says, be renewed in the spirit of your mind. Verse 24, so that you, and that you put on the new man, which was created according to God in true righteousness and holiness. So this is saying that not only do you put away your former way of life, but you need to be renewed and put on the new man. Get rid of the old man, put on the new man. And then it says, which was created according to God in true righteousness and holiness. And what another, I'm going to bore you with some grammatical stuff, sorry, but to be renewed, that's a passive verb. That means it's something that is done to you. You can't renew yourself, okay? There are things we have to do, yes, but there are things that God has to do. God has to renew us, and we'll see later, by his Holy Spirit. We have to allow ourselves to be renewed. But it tells us to put off the old man, put on the new man. So that indicates that's an active verb. That's something that we need to do. And so we'll talk more about that today and next time as well. Verses 23 and 4 in New Living is expressed this way. It says, instead of, you know, the old way of life, instead let the Spirit renew your thoughts and attitudes. So there it tells us how that's, they changed to an active verb, but it still is talking about God's Spirit, which is true doctrinally. Put on your new nature, created to be like God, truly righteous and holy. So renewing of the mind through the Holy Spirit is the key to putting off the old man. You don't just say, well, I got to get rid of all these qualities. I got to change these things. I got to quit doing these things. And even for that matter, if you quit doing things, if you don't do something good in its place, what benefit is that? I mean, God is looking for positive qualities, not looking for an absence of negative qualities. He's looking for positive qualities. But it just so happens that, again, it really helps tremendously to replace a bad habit with a good habit. It's just the way we're put together, which I don't think is an accident. I think God planned it that way in purpose. Going on to verse 25, therefore, putting away lying, let each one of you speak truth with his neighbor, for we are members of one another. So what that's telling us, obviously, is we need to quit lying, but we need to replace that with speaking the truth. So that's something you want to take a look at, really, because we tend to think, well, I don't think I lie anymore. You might be surprised if you could take a closer look at things. And what's bad about lying is it's a form of deception and a form of betrayal. New Living puts it this way. It makes it more clear, I think. It says, so stop telling lies. Let us tell our neighbors the truth, for we are all parts of the same body. Now, what is that talking about? It's relating to the fact that lying and versus truth is important not just for us, but for the people that we have relationships with. And if you've ever dealt with a person who is a chronic liar, you got no basis for communication. I remember a counseling years ago in another church area where this individual, it was a marriage problem situation, and the husband was a chronic liar. We couldn't help him because everything he said, we just think, well, we don't know if this is true or not. Unfortunately, chronic liars get to a point where I think they actually believe this stuff. And they're in this kind of la-la world that is not reality whatsoever. And obviously that has a very bad effect on other people. So it's talking about the fact that we are members of one another. In a relationship, one of the important qualities of a relationship, whether you're talking about marriage or in the church or in the family or on the job, in school or whatever, is you have to be able to trust somebody. And if somebody is not truthful, you can't trust them. You never know what they say is going to be accurate. It's almost like in another way, which is a little pretty much harmless, some people are chronic jokers. You know, there's a minister that is deceased now that was that way. You all know him, right? And he's always joking. Well, that wasn't a problem because you knew to expect that, and he kind of made his point. It was low keyed, and I'm talking about Mr. Scriber. You know, you talk about Alice and all this stuff, and so, and that's fine. But when people tell lies, that's not fine. That's not good. There's no benefit from that whatsoever. So the thing is that lying, it really takes advantage of people because, especially we as God's people, tend to be hopefully innocent and trusting. One of the things it says about love in 1 Corinthians 13 is believes all things. And the bad side of that, of course, is naivete, if you believe stuff that's really not true. Probably better to err on that side than it is to err on the other side and just not trust anybody. But people get to be that way, too, after they're hurt by lies and by cheating. And we obviously have dealt with that in our past in the church culture, so we kind of know what that's all about. Speaking of which, lying is something that's done oftentimes by individuals in authority for a selfish gain. Something in the news right now every day that is a good example of that, I don't mean good morally, but of lying. Presidential campaign. Can you believe all this stuff these guys say? I've read articles. I mean, I don't listen to it, so I don't know. But according to what I've read, they said half the stuff that some of these guys say is just not even true. In fact, I heard something, and I maybe shouldn't bring it up because I don't know the deal on it, but somebody was telling me that during one of the political campaigns that actually the speaking system was turned off on purpose because this guy, what he was saying, wasn't really true. And even the other politicians didn't want to be heard by people. So I don't know. I just stay away from that. I'd rather spend my time on fun things like pounding my thumb with a hammer or something. You know, it's joking, but... All right, so I'm going to read you a quotation here now from the New Daily Study Bible. It kind of elaborates a little bit about this ingredient of lying because it involves a lot more things than sometimes what we realize. He says, Paul has just been saying that when people become Christians, they must put off their old life as they would put off a coat for which they have no further use. We'll talk more about that later. It's a very interesting analogy. Here he speaks of the things which must be banished from the Christian life. There must be no more falsehood. There is more than one kind of lie in the world. There's the lie of speech, sometimes deliberate, and sometimes almost unconscious. It's more from carelessness about truth than from intentional lying. There is so much that there is so much falsehood in the world. Truth demands a deliberate effort. So sometimes we just are careless. We say something, it's not really true, and maybe we don't even realize it's not intentional. But if we say it to somebody, We're accountable for that. If we tell somebody, you ought to do this, and it's wrong, or it's kind of something you have to give account for. That's what's so bad about gossip. Gossip oftentimes simply isn't true. And you spread it to somebody else, it's hurtful, it's damaging, and unfortunately it's not true. So there again, I mean, the Bible says we have to give account for that because God is concerned when those things happen. Going on with the quote, it says there's also the lie of silence. And maybe it's even more common. It may be that in some discussion, we, by our silence, give approval to some course of action, which we know is wrong. It may be that we withhold warning or rebuke when we know quite well we should have given it. Boy, is that true. I hear so many times somebody will tell me something that was said in church by somebody. It was inappropriate. And I'll say, well, did anybody say anything? Well, no. Somebody should. That's what this is saying here. And there are scriptures about that, too, that might be worth a whole sermon. In love, frankly, because we are responsible to do everything we can to maintain unity of the Spirit. And lying and hurtful words, inappropriate things that are said, are damaging and need to be stopped. You know, not self-righteously or anything like that, but just simply out of concern for, including the person. Sometimes the person may not be aware that what they're saying is damaging. Or maybe they had a bad day or whatever it is, but like I said before, it's like somebody with salad between their teeth. If nobody tells them, they're the only one in the room that doesn't know it's wrong. Of course, there are cases where obviously people know when they're doing something wrong, but it still helps for somebody to say something. It really helps. So this is something that we can lie by being silent. Because silence sometimes indicates, well, nobody said anything, nobody had a problem with it, so I guess it was okay. Well, that's not the case, obviously. Going on to the quote, it says, Paul gives the reason for telling the truth. It's because we are all members of the same body. We can live in safety only because the senses and nerves, this is talking about our bodies now, using an analogy to make the point of how important it is to the body of Christ to tell the truth. He's going to use the example of the human body. We can live in safety only because the senses and the nerves pass true messages to the brain. If they took to passing false messages, if, for example, they told the brain that something was cool and touchable when, in fact, it was hot and burning, that wouldn't be so good, would it? Life could even come to an end, as it says. A body can function healthily only when each part of it passes true messages to the brain. If we're all bound into one body, spiritually that means, that body can function properly only when we speak the truth. I think it's pretty obvious lesson. We need to speak the truth. Actually, there's another verse in chapter 4, I think it's verse 15, I don't have it in my notes, but it says that we need to speak the truth with love. You don't just hit somebody smack in the face with the truth, you say it in a loving way. But if our communication lacks either of those qualities, it's not going to be productive. You have to have truth and love. I've mentioned it many, many times. Of course, another serious thing about lying is that it originated from whom? Who was the first liar? Satan, the devil. And he's still active at that. John 8:44 says, when he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own resources, for he's a liar and the father of it. New Living puts it this way, he has always hated the truth because there's no truth in him. When he lies, it's consistent with his character, for he is a liar and the father of lies. So lying is an activity or an action. A liar is a chronic liar. And hopefully we don't have very many, if any of those, in the body of Christ. But we don't even want lies at all, let alone chronic liars. Revelation 21:8 says that unrepentant liars will be destroyed in the lake of fire. So it's pretty serious. It's pretty serious. But we live in a very untruthful world. So much false advertising, the partial truths. How many, speaking of ingredients, how many times do you have products in your home that will say no preservatives added or no sweetener added. You know why? Because it's already got preservatives in the ingredients, so they didn't add any. It makes you think, oh, well, there's no preservatives in this. No, that's not true. Do you think that they don't know better than that? Of course they know better. And so if sugar is the bad thing, they'll say, no sugar. So they put in high fructose corn syrup instead, which is worse. And now people realize, well, that's worse, so sugar is not as bad as that. So they'll say, natural sweetener, that means sugar. Whatever the public wants to hear, you know, they'll tell you the half-truth. And truth in advertising, remember that? Those laws, do they do any good? Nah. I think it's worse now than ever has been. Unfortunately, lying is an integral part of human nature and Satan's way, and it's the world we live in. But we need to make sure that we're putting that out of our lives. Okay, let's go on to verse 26 and 7 of Ephesians 4. Be angry and do not sin. It sounds like unusual. But there is such a thing as righteous anger. Now, most of the time, it's not when it comes to us. Is it James 1, 8, 9 or so that says that the wrath of man doesn't work the righteousness of God? We tend to think, oh, I'm justified by this anger, and most of the time anger is self-centered. But it does acknowledge that anger is sometimes is okay, depending upon the situation. But it says, don't sin in the process. Pretty hard thing to do. Jesus was angry, right? He didn't sin. He was angry for a just cause. It's hard to imagine love and anger being one and the same. But you parents ever get angry at your kids? Is that justified when they disobey you? Yeah. I think some probably psychologists will say, oh, no, you don't ever want to get angry. Just pat your little one on the head and say, oh, that's okay, and reason with them, that kind of thing. No, anger is something that God gives us as a tool. It can be used without sinning. But it's a temporary thing. Because it goes on to say, don't let the sun go down on your wrath, nor give place to the devil. What are we talking about here? Don't let the sun go down in your wrath is a way of saying anger needs to be dealt with very soon, before it gets worse, gets out of hand. Because anger is like lighting a match. Okay, if you're careless with a match, you can throw it down in something and start a forest fire. Sometimes some of the most damaging forest fires were started by one careless match or a cigarette thrown outside the window or something like that. Also, anger, of course, can, with the help of Satan, lead to what Hebrews 12:15 calls a root of bitterness. Satan can work on you if you're angry, if you nurse that anger. And before you know it, you can be in a lot more trouble. I've said this many times before. It's a quote I came across a number of years ago. It says, if you... your anger toward a person, I'm kind of paraphrasing, I don't remember the exact quote, but if you're angry with a person and you hold on to the anger, it's like you're taking poison and waiting for that person you're angry at to die. Who's it going to hurt? The other person doesn't even know you're angry. Well, unless you are there and you yell at them or something like that. But even then, anger raises your blood pressure, does all kinds of things that are really not helpful, even to the individual who's angry, let alone the victim of that. The New Living Translation puts it this way, don't sin by letting anger control you. Don't let the sun go down while you're still angry. In verse 27, I think that makes that a lot more clear. For anger gives a foothold to the devil. Remember the scripture that says that Satan goes about like roaring lion seeking to devour? He's looking for a foothold. He's looking for a little niche in there that he can get in there and cause all kinds of problems by false accusations. By getting you to feel sorry for yourself, by putting in assumptions and accusations that are not correct and exacerbating the situation. The best way to deal with things like that is immediately get the situation clarified. Well, I say immediately. First thing you do is ask God to help you to get rid of your anger. Because when you're angry, I've said this before too, but it's important. When you're angry, a lot of the blood leaves your head. It goes to your hands and feet for fight or flight. And your brain doesn't work too well without enough oxygen. Okay, that's what the blood does. It carries oxygen to the brain. So that needs to be dealt with very, very speedily. And fortunately, I've had a number of occasions where somebody will call me up with something they heard. And I'll tell them, well, no, that's not true. This is what the situation is. Anytime you hear something that's concerning to you, get it clarified. Go to the source. Go to somebody that can set you straight on it. Don't just sit there and just say, well, it's not important. Don't kid yourself. Get it clarified for the sake of your peace of mind. Going on to verse 28, let him who stole steal no longer, but rather let him labor, working with his hands what is good, so that he may have something to give him who has need. So basically here in the same sentence, you're talking about replacing stealing with doing something good, with working with your hands or working however, so that you have the money to not only for yourself, but to help other people as well. So instead of stealing from other people, you need to be helping other people as you have opportunity to do so. So it's telling us stealing and cheating needs to be replaced by a giving attitude and honesty. What do you suppose is one of the most common examples of cheating and lying that's this time of year? Income tax. Yeah, exactly. Income tax. Boy, I tell you, I've... Yeah, there's this company called, you can have your tax done, they're called Dewey, Cheatham & Howe. Yeah. No, I used to have a tax business, and I had somebody come in one time, and I've told this story before, so if you remember it, you can roll your eyes, and I'll be quick. And he said, so I want to get all my income tax back. I said, well, we'll see what we can do. So we went down the list and gave me his deductions and things, and his $52 contributions to church. That's a dollar a week, you know, basically. Came down to it, and there's still taxes. Okay, so make that $104. Pretty soon I realized, you know, he's just throwing out figures here. He's lying to me. And I told him, I said, look, I can't help you. I can't be a party to your lying. Just go somewhere else, get your tax done. There was another guy that I had as a customer in bookkeeping. And he would—he thought he was really smart. One of his lines was, he said, well, I don't worry about IRS or anybody because they can't eat you. Well, that's true. But anyway, what he would do, he would turn in every little bit of income, just a few dollars worth. But he would leave off the major ones. He thought he was smart. Well, I don't know whatever happened to him, but I would assume sooner or later probably caught up with him. Well, there's another form of stealing that can happen in our church culture. It's found in Malachi chapter 3 and verse 8. If you're familiar with that one. It's one thing to rob from IRS. One of the things about the Old West is that some of the criminals that robbed railroads were popular with the people because people hated the railroads. People hate IRS, so they think, well, you know, they don't spend the money right anyway, and blah, blah, blah. Well, you can't say this about this particular source. Malachi 3:8 says, will a man rob God? Yet you have robbed me, but you say, well, in what way have we robbed you? Answer, in tithes and offerings. New Living puts it this way, should people cheat God? Yet you cheated me. But you ask, what do you mean? When did we ever cheat you? You have cheated me of the tithes and offerings due to me. And that's self-explanatory. Self-explanatory. Probably some of us in this room have been guilty of that. I remember an example in my past. It wasn't deliberate, but then you got the milk in the carpet thing. You can say something wasn't deliberate, but still, the milk's in the carpet. What I mean is the kids would accidentally knock a glass of milk over and, oh, it was an accident. I'll say, yeah, but the milk is still in the carpet. I hope it wasn't deliberate. But still, the carpet doesn't know the difference. It's still got milk in it. So the point was this, that it was when I was in Big Sandy, ambassador, and I had cashed my paycheck, and I put the second tithe. I had a billfold that had two compartments. I put it in the back, okay, and had the other funds in the front. And I thought, well, I'm going to, I guess that was one example. I think the one I was thinking of, though, was that the cash that was in there, that's what it was, the cash that was in there was second tithe, and I was in town on my motor scooter and needed to buy something, didn't have my checkbook. I said, well, I'll just use this, and I'll write a check for it when I get back to campus. Not a good idea. Not only was that not a good idea, but I got back to campus, I forgot to do it. The next time I got my bank statement, I was way overdrawn because I made some horrendous error. It took me 2 or 3 months to get caught up. But that was a lesson I still remember to this day. You know, God's auditing is a lot more accurate than IRS's auditing. Your chances of being audited by IRS are pretty slim. But you can't get by with anything where God's concerned. In love, he's going to, if you rob from him, you're going to pay the price. He's going to bring this to your attention, and it's not necessarily going to be fun. I can tell you that from my own personal experience. Okay, let's go on to verse 29. Let no corrupt word proceed out of your mouth, but what is good for necessary edification, that it may impart grace to the hearers. Boy, that's one we probably all have offended in. In fact, I think it's in James 3, isn't it, where it says, if anybody doesn't offend with his tongue, they're a perfect person. Every one of us have said things that were not productive. Every one of us. Possibly, very possibly, even sometime last week. So that's one that will get us all. Corrupt communication can be foul language. A lot of people think foul language is cool. There are some people that can't talk without using the F word about every other word in a sentence. Some of these athletes that you see, they interview, they'll be interviewing, and he'll say something, and bleep, and then say something else, bleep. Anyway, that's not cool at all. Language is a communication tool that needs to be used for good, not for evil. So there again, that covers a wide range of things. Gossip, slander, foul language, off-color jokes, things that are, as in camp terminology, are outside of the zone. Okay, we're going to read verse 31 here before we move on to another verse, 31-32, before we move on to Colossians' account, which is considerably shorter, so we won't spend as much time there. Verse 31 gives us several different ingredients, all of which are somewhat similar. In fact, these are some of the most common qualities that are listed in the scriptures need to be put away, are different forms of negative forms of anger. Because anger takes many, many forms. It lists in verse 31, let all bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, and evil speaking but be put away from you with all malice. So there's what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 things that are mentioned. So let's read a description of those ingredients from Barclay's New Study Bible. Barclay says, Paul ends this chapter with a list of things which must go from life. There's bitterness. The Greeks define this word as a long-standing resentment, the spirit which refuses to be reconciled. So many of us have a way of nursing our anger to keep it warm, of brooding over the insults and the injuries which we've received. As Christians, we might well pray that God would teach us how to forgive. Or we might say forgive and forget. Let it go. Just let it go. Sounds simple, but you can do it. Don't hang on to it. Don't nurse it, because it's not doing you any good to hang on to it. It's another whole subject that's worth more coverage, which we'll do at some later time. Number two, there are outbursts of passion and also long-lived anger. The Greeks define the word here, thumos, as the kind of anger which is like the flame which comes from straw. It quickly blazes up and just as quickly subsides. You know when people like that? They just explode with anger. And as you're lying there on the floor bleeding and bruised and everything, they're laughing and they're all over it, and You know, and I don't know, people like that, I don't know if they even realize. It happens so quick and they explode, I don't think they realize how much damage they're doing to somebody in the process. Very dangerous. Hurts the other person, doesn't help the angry person either, for that matter. On the other hand, they describe orge, that's the other word, that's the first two words on that in the list there. The wrath is the quick explosion type of thing, and this next word is defined as a kind of anger which is like the flame, which, I'm sorry. The next one is, on the other hand, they describe this other one as anger which has become habitual. To Christians, the burst of temper and the long-lived anger are both forbidden. Thirdly, there's loud talking and insulting language. A certain famous preacher tells how his wife used to advise him, in the pulpit, keep your voice down. I remember Ernie Hoyt, remember him? He used to say, you know, spirituality is not measured in decibels. He was never very loud in what he said. Very loving individual, but never really was loud. Some people think that if you really talk loud, boy, that's really spiritual. Not necessarily. A lot of people talk loud that are anything but spiritual. Hitler was pretty loud, right? So those are two different things. Goes on to say, whenever in any discussion or argument we become aware that our voice is raised, it's time to stop. Now, women pick up on that quicker than men do. They'll say, you yelled at me, and I think, oh, is that the case? You tend to think of a raising your voice as being volume, but sometimes just the intensity is so strong that it's like yelling. By the way, now, I don't know if you know this or not, but some people in the email, they put things in uppercase. I read somewhere that uppercase is like shouting in print. So don't do that. I don't think any of you do. I haven't seen you do it. But all right, so qualities put on to replace those put off. Verse 32 tells us, be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, just as God in Christ forgave you. That's what you replace anger with. You know, God forgives us, right? So we need to forgive others. New Daily Study Bible sums up that. It says, so Paul comes to the summing up of his advice. He tells us to be kind. The Greeks define this Greek word as the attitude of mind which thinks as much of its neighbor's affairs as it does of its own. So what Mr. Armstrong is called, the way of give, rather than the way of get. Kindness has learned the secret of looking outwards all the time and not inwards. He tells us to forgive others as God forgave us. So in one sentence, Paul lays down the law of personal relationships that we should treat others as Jesus Christ has treated us. I remember the example of my dear friend, Mr. Luker. I've told this before, but it comes to mind. I'll share it again. There's an individual that came up to him when, and this is years ago, he's just really angry about some issues in church. And Mr. Luker listened to him, and when the guy finally finished, Mr. Luker went up to him, hugged him, said, I love you. That guy's an elder in United now, probably partly because of that example. A lot of people would have said, just riled out, you know, and said, who are you to talk to me like that? I can think of another example, too. It's kind of interesting. When I sold my bookkeeping and tax business, and I apologize again if you've heard this before, but when I ask people, they tend to forget. So it was bought by a guy who had 50 years of tax experience, an old, stubborn German. And I had no experience, none, ninguna. Never took a class in high school, college. Didn't take Block's tax course until I'd been in business for 2 years. But when you go out, I mean, you can imagine, you go out and deliver somebody their taxes. What do you suppose they say? Oh, thank you, thank you. I needed that. They look, what? Yeah, I was kind of, what are you? And they cuss you out. And I realize, look, it's not me. I'm just the messenger. I didn't take it personally. I was outward thinking. I thought, yeah, I can understand. I'd usually joke with a person or, you know, calm them down, things like that. And even though we're mad, I kept those customers because of that PR thing. This guy that bought the business said, I'm not going to take that from people. I thought, okay. He didn't either. He lost every single customer in the first year. There you go. You know, it pays to do things God's way. I can tell you from personal examples in my life, and certainly plenty of examples I've seen the lives of others as well. Not to say that I never got upset or never do, because I do. I'm human, obviously, we all are. But you learn from that too. It just doesn't help to do things the wrong way. So we're dealing with a situation there where it tells us just to be kind, be outward thinking and outward in our approach. Okay, let's go to Colossians chapter 3. And I'm going to read verses 12 through 14. Wait a minute, what did I... Oh, I've skipped it. I wondered what... I'm sorry, back up on here. I turned another page while I was talking. My brain wasn't working. My hand was out of control. See what happens when your brain doesn't... when your body doesn't work together? I thought, man, we didn't go to Colossians yet. Okay, the parallel passage in Colossians, chapter 3, and verses 1 through 4 of Colossians 3. If then you were raised with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ is, sitting at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above, not on things on the earth. For you died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. And when Christ, who is our life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. So, verse 5 goes on. I'm going to switch here to New Living. It says, so put to death the sinful earthly things lurking within you. Have nothing to do with sexual immorality, impurity, lust, and evil desires. Don't be greedy, for a greedy person is an idolater, worshiping things of this world. And now he gives another list of these anger qualities that are similar to what we read in Ephesians. Verses 8 through 10 of Colossians 3. But now you yourselves are to put off all these: anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy language out of your mouth. Do not lie to one another, since you put off the old man with his deeds, and have put on, there's a put off, put on again, the new man who is renewed in knowledge according to the image of him who created him. Barclay says in verse 8, Paul says there are certain things of which the Corinthians must strip themselves. The word he uses is the word for taking off clothes. There's here a picture from the life of the early Christians. When Christians were baptized, they took off their old clothes and went down into the water. And when they emerged, they put on new, pure, white robes. Now, I don't know if they went in the water totally without clothes on. I wouldn't recommend that today. But the point is that they had this symbolism. They had these old clothes, and then when they were baptized, they put on this new, pure, white robes. They got rid of one kind of life and put on another. In this passage, Paul speaks of the things of which Christians must rid themselves. And in verse 12, he will continue the picture and speak of the things which Christians must put on. Let's look at these things one by one that are to be put off. Christians must rid themselves of anger and temper. The word temper is wrath in the New King James. The two words we saw earlier are orge and thumos. And the difference between them is this. Thumos is a blaze of sudden anger which is quickly ignited and just as quickly dies. The Greeks likened to fire and straw, which quickly blazed and just as quickly burned itself out. Orge is the anger which has become ingrained, its long-lasting, slow-burning anger, which refuses to be pacified and nurses its wrath to keep it warm. For Christians, a burst of temper and long-lasting anger are both forbidden. There's malice. The word we have translated in this way is a difficult word to translate, for it really means the viciousness of mind from which all individual vices spring. It's an all-pervading evil. Christians must rid themselves of slander and foul talk, and they must not lie to one another. The word for slander is blasphemia, which the Authorized Version translates as blasphemy. Blasphemia is insulting and slanderous speaking in general. When that insulting speech is directed against God, it becomes blasphemy. In this context, it is much more likely that what's forbidden is slanderous talk against other people. The word we have translated foul talk could well mean obscene language. These three forbidden things all have to do with our speech. Okay, now then, Colossians 3, 12 through 14. Therefore, which says conclusion, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering, bearing with one another, and forgiving one another. If anyone has a complaint against another, even as Christ forgave you, so you also must do. But above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection. You know, as a personal Bible study, you might just take those negative qualities and put them on one side and the positive qualities on the other side and kind of match them up and see which one is to replace which one of the bad ones. The New Living in verse 14 says, above all, clothe yourselves with love, which binds us all together in perfect harmony. So the qualities to put on or put in will result in spiritual bonding and unity, whereas the other qualities obviously can tear apart a congregation or a family or whatever. Garments are symbols of our conduct, right? It's a Bible symbol for conduct, like, for example, it talks about other scriptures being clothed with righteousness. And here's the thing, God provides us with the clothes. Now, you ladies really enjoy going out and getting a new garment, don't you? Isn't that nice? I even like it once in a while. As men, probably not so much, but it's kind of nice. God provides that. We still have to put it on. Now, sometimes Karen's bought me things, and see, some things I haven't put them on yet. It doesn't do me any good until I put it on, right? Same thing. God provides the character through His Spirit. He's willing to do that, but we have to put the initiative forth to put it into practice, to put it on. Let's conclude in 1 John 3, verses 1 through 3. Because this is basically kind of sums up what the days of unleavened bread are all about, to motivate us to do, that is. And it really ties in with Pentecost too, by the way. 1 John 3, verse 1 says, behold, what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us, that we should be called children of God. In other words, take a look, consider what that means, to be God's children. Therefore, the world doesn't know us because it didn't know Him. But beloved, now we are children of God, and it's not yet been revealed what we shall be, but we know that when He's revealed, we shall be like Him, for we shall see Him as He is. A vast improvement over physical life, right? Should motivate us, is the point here. Everyone who has this hope in Him purifies himself just as He is pure. It's telling us that that should motivate us to put forth the effort, to put out the things that are counterproductive to that process, and to do so by putting in the qualities that God provides through His Spirit to be righteous, to be, have our conduct to be righteous. The hope of the resurrection is one of the meanings of the day of Pentecost, which comes up after the spring holiday season, that we are first fruits. It should motivate us to purify ourselves. And again, notice the emphasis on our initiative. Now, it doesn't mean we can purify ourselves on our own. We can go to Walmart or somewhere and get this purification kit and get our spiritual character purified. There's an essential oil called Purify that Karen uses, but it doesn't help any with our spiritual conduct. It'd be nice if it did. Wouldn't it be easy? And you just put some of that on you and kind of like Popeye or spinach, all of a sudden you're a righteous person. And that's something God has to do, but we have to, again, use that God gives us. And the present tense here indicates a continuous, ongoing process, day by day. It's our lifelong assignment. So we need to endeavor to put out sin and put in the holy, righteous character that God provides and allow Him and Jesus Christ to live and work in us through the power of the Holy Spirit. And so as it says in 1 Corinthians 5, verse 8, therefore, let us keep the feast, not with the old leaven, not with all those bad ingredients, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth.